Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, our topic is the magnificent ecosystem engineer, the beaver, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Reese Mercer of the Western Beavers Cooperative. Welcome, Reese. Can you tell us more about yourself?
Julie, hello, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Western Beavers Cooperative and myself, we work a lot out in Eastern Oregon landscapes, but of course, all of Oregon. We are working to support beaver habitat recovery and also support landowners, especially private working lands that have beavers coming in and kind of mucking up things and infrastructure, doing the wrong things in the wrong places. And so we feel like if we can support keeping the water moving on those infrastructure places, we can keep beavers in place, and then also providing habitat for them as well. So working a lot with soil and water conservation districts and watershed restoration agencies to help them with their beaver projects and to get more thinking about how to help beavers in their recovery in our state.
Great. I know California has had an issue for years and years because so many people thought beavers were not native to California, and we're now realizing that they are. How about Oregon? Tell me about the beaver and Oregon. What's its history with our state?
Oh gosh, what a great question, because it just happens to be the 200th year anniversary of when beavers got really almost completely eliminated from our state. So beavers are really one of our oldest living residents of Oregon State. I like to say they're a 7-million-year-old resident. And what a lot of folks don't really realize, and I love to tell this story, is beavers are really responsible for a lot of our agricultural abundance that we have in the state. Because if you can imagine a critter like a beaver who's semi-aquatic and semi-terrestrial, but they need to be in water in order to be safe from predators. And so to do that, a lot of times, not everywhere, but a lot of times, they'll build dams, especially out on smaller wadable streams. And when they build dams, what that does is it builds up sediment that comes down from the top of the watershed. And over time, as you can imagine, over millennia, if you can get hundreds and thousands of years of beaver damming, capturing sediment, capturing water, and all kinds of organic matter that gets held back through these beaver dams, over time, what you start to get is these really rich, abundant beaver meadows full of organic materials and rich, kind of fertile stream valley floors. And so really, when the trappers of 200 years ago came into the state of Oregon, and I've got a lot of history around that if you're interested to hear it, but the trappers came in through Hudson Bay Company, and they eliminated all the beavers really as a way, sort of a scorched earth policy by the Brits. They eliminated all of the beavers from the landscape. And when they did that, those streams weren't maintained anymore. They weren't rebuilt. And it created a cataclysmic effect, really, on the environment of the dams being gone. And now the increased stream power started to erode these stream channels and just disconnect the floodplains. And what happened really was sort of this devastation that we've never fully recovered from. So the very rough kind of estimates that I hear from time to time are that we probably back then had about 1 million beavers on the landscape, really roughly, and they were in every corner of the state. Even out here on these high desert, really arid regions, there were beaver everywhere out here forming our fertile beaver valley meadow floors. But now the best guess is we probably are at about 5% of the population of beavers that we had had compared to 200 years ago. So they really are just a shadow of their former selves in terms of populations and numbers in the state. And a lot of that had to do with the original assault on beavers 200 years ago. It really was marked in 1824 that all of this took place. And we've never really since been able to recover our beaver populations.
Well, what do you mean assault? Weren't they just, wasn't the Hudson Company just hunting beavers for their pelts? Wasn't it just hunting?
Yeah. So of course there was this big enterprise and this economic engine of beaver pelts as a natural resource back in the day, right? That was beaver pelts are really what drove a lot of westward expansion of the Americans and then also the Brits and the Hudson Bay Company coming down from Canada. It was a huge enterprise. It was really the natural resource of our time. It was before we had timber harvesting or gold mining or anything like that. What we had was beaver pelts. And so back in the day, there was this question of Oregon and the Oregon Territory, and it was really one of the very last remaining areas of the continent that hadn't been fully settled by these different warring nations. I mean, everyone was involved. It was Spain and Russia and Britain and probably France to some degree, and of course, America. And everybody wanted this really rich territory of Oregon country. And really, it was the United States and Britain that were uniquely positioned to be able to take occupancy of the territory and to really make a strong claim to it. And of course, America was a young nation at the time and felt like they had to have it. They wanted east to west control of the whole continent. And they had created an agreement with the Brits in 1818. It was called the Treaty of 1818, where they agreed for 10 years to hold off on settling the question of Oregon and who gets Oregon and why. It was Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And so they'd been warring a lot. They were getting kind of tired. And they said, let's put this question on hold for 10 years. Well, in the meantime, both countries were like, how are we going to strengthen our hold on that territory so that when 10 years expires, we know that we can really make the claim and have that be our own part of the country? Britain wanted it for Canada, and President James Monroe wanted it for America. And so, in this time of 1818, Hudson Bay Company was uniquely positioned coming down out of Canada. They had lots of infrastructure. They had forts on the Columbia River Basin. And they said, let's create a fur desert. I mean, this was actually a policy pursuit on behalf of the British government through the Hudson Bay Company. It was really a scorched earth policy. And they felt like if they could eliminate all of the beaver, the number one natural resource, as sort of a dead zone or a buffer zone in between the Oregon Trail, right? American settlers were coming in from Missouri. The Oregon Trail had just gotten started in 1811. And they felt if they could delay American settlement by creating this beaver dead zone, that that might be a way that they could have the upper hand on the territory when it came time to settle this question of who was going to get it once and for all. And so that's what they did. So a gentleman named Peter Skeen Ogden, who's kind of a big name in these parts, and you'll see him on a lot of roadside signs around Eastern Oregon especially, but Peter Skeen Ogden was the main dude for Hudson Bay Company. And he received very explicit instructions from Governor George Simpson. He was the head of the Hudson Bay Company. And he was told in no uncertain terms to eliminate every beaver that his trappers would encounter in between. It was called the Snake River Expedition. So it was really the area to the east of the Snake River. And of course, the Snake River goes up into the Columbia. So it was south of the Columbia and east of the Snake River, which of course, those are the boundary lines for Oregon. And so they sent through Peter Skeen Ogden brigade after brigade of anywhere from 30 to 50 trappers through the territories. They started out in Fort Vancouver and then Fort Nez Perce as well. And they dropped down from the Deschutes River into the Crooked River Basin, which is an area where I work a lot over by Prineville and the Crooked River. And then they went into Boise, Idaho, and all the way over to the Continental Divide, so up through Utah. So this happened for a period of about 5 to 10 years. And within that time, they kept coming back year after year because the beaver hunting was so good in that area. And you can see quotes from Ogden saying how sinful it is that there was no attempt at a sustainable harvest. It was all about eliminating the beaver. And he has quotes in there about mothers having kits and young of anywhere from 4 to 6 beavers, and they just absolutely eliminated them. So they knew what they were doing, and they were very efficient and very effective at doing it. And within a matter of 5 to 10 years, they quit coming because there were no more beaver to be had. So the 5% of beaver population I mentioned earlier, that is kind of a rough guess at what we think we have on the land today. Those are really the remnant, kind of the descendants of the beavers that were the most shy and the most probably proficient at hiding from these Hudson Bay trappers. So it was really a very, very different time 200 years ago from what it is today in terms of beavers on the landscape.
Wow, that's interesting. It almost affected their evolution. I mean, you said that the shy ones were the survivors. That's fascinating. I didn't realize that. And I do know that the Hudson Bay Company, way back in the day, had a reputation out east of being sustainably harvesting beavers because they recognized that, you need to keep the source going if you want to keep harvesting in the future. But I guess their strategy was not necessarily harvesting for pelts altogether. It was getting rid of them. So they were not an attraction for other settlers. Wow.
I mean, it's really, as I and I would, for anyone interested in this, what sort of opened my eyes to it was a paper by actually a historian. I think she's out of Roseburg. Her name is Jennifer Ott. She lives in Seattle now, but 20 years ago, she wrote a paper for the Oregon Historical Society called The Ruining of the Snake Rivers, or something like that. Get it kind of wrong every time, but this tells the story in the Oregon Historical Society, this story that she wrote about what was happening with the Hudson Bay Company. And she really put this camp, it was a campaign between 1820, I think she starts it at 1823, but the real trapping started in 1824. From 1824 to 1841 is really when this policy was in place through Hudson Bay Company. And she does an incredible job of telling this story and kind of what happened.
Wow. And the beavers never, I don't know, they never regained their reputation. Beavers have a reputation of being the largest rodent in America. And rodents do not have a good reputation overall. And when people say it's the largest rodent, then others assume, yeah, rodent means bad. Let's get rid of it. Rodents carry diseases. Rodents destroy your pipes and your water. But lately, I think so much research has been focused on the beaver that we've now become more knowledgeable about them and we realize they're actually a keystone species. Can you define keystone species for me?
Yeah, and I love that you bring that up about rodents. I mean, we can all be many things, right? Like it's not always just black and white. And so there's some wonderful things about rodents, and especially about beavers. So they can be problematic when they're in the wrong place to human beings. But what's wonderful about them is that when you get them on the stream, water's life. And beavers know that more than probably any other creature, and they are a master engineer at putting water where they want it and making sure that they have that escape cover from predators. So when they're holding back that water in the cases where beavers do den building, and even where, or dam building, excuse me, and even in cases where they're not dam building, they're also building channels, side channels in lakes and ponds and other, large, fast rivers. They're always doing maintenance and engineering on their stream. They can't help themselves. They're busy beavers. And so when they do this, what this does is it makes a system dynamic and it holds that water in on the land. And when it does that, it changes the vegetation in that space. It allows slow places for fish fry to hang out, it and for invertebrates and amphibians to have the kind of habitat that they need. So they're just really essential to creating habitat and varied habitat for a large range of species. So when you go and look at the Oregon conservation strategy that ODFW has written, and it's really the guiding document by which they manage wildlife in our state, And for here in our eastern region, 39% of the species that are listed as either endangered or threatened species, either federally or statewide, 39% of those really endangered species are species that rely on the kind of habitat that beavers provide. So when we don't have that beaver habitat, when we don't have beavers doing that damming or building those channels or even cutting down trees to some degree, we don't have habitat for those other critters. So that has been, I think, as you noted, our relationship with beavers is changing. I think some of our tolerance around some of the infrastructure concerns that we have with beavers, especially when humans put infrastructure in places that are really attractive to beavers. I mean, that kind of, we got to take ownership of that on our end, right? Like not building in floodplains. And of course, irrigation, points of diversion and culverts, those are great pinch points for beavers to want to dam on those things. So what I'd like to see us do as human engineers is start thinking a little bit more closely about the infrastructure that we're putting in place and not making it so attractive to beavers to give them a head start on their engineering feats. But yeah, without the activities of the beavers in many places, we just don't have that habitat that a lot of our other wildlife species in the state really need to thrive.
Well, tell me, you mentioned the beavers hold the water back. Isn't that only useful for where their water is held back? In other words, when they put it in a channel, does it just stay in that channel? Isn't it just limited to that channel? Or is that water held for other purposes beyond that very physical space of that specific channel?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Beavers do not store water. I think that's a word that I've really recognized is not helpful to this whole conversation, especially if you're a downstream landowner. I mean, that would really make you nervous, right? To think that the beavers are upstream holding back all that water. They just slow it down. And what they do, if you were to look at what the scientists call a hydrograph, where you've got on the, I think it's the y-axis where you have the discharge of water coming down. So especially over here on the east of the state, we have really flashy stream systems. So the water melts off with snow really fast in the spring, and then it just melts off and then it's gone. It goes out to the ocean. Well, what happens when you have those beaver dams in place is it just slows the water down and it pushes that water a lot of times hyperrheically underground. And then the water surfaces again. So it's, well, what we call sub-irrigate. It will go underground for a little while. And then what it does is it comes back later. So it will flatten out that hydrograph that I was talking about so that we don't have this whole blip in one period of time where it just rushes out to the ocean, but it actually starts to saturate the sponge of the land and hold the water or slow the water down on that land. And the other thing too, if you look at a beaver dam, it's not like a human dam, right? Like we human engineers think we're so smart because we go in and hold all this water back with cement that is non-porous, right? And so beaver dams, you'll see if you're at a beaver dam, there's actually water coming through that dam. And there's a whole water column, you know, from the bottom of that pond to the middle of the pond to the top of the pond, the water's coming through the whole dam. It's not just spilling over hot water at the top of the dam like it would on a human-made dam, but it's spilling through on that whole dam. And then what it's doing is going underneath hyperrheically, kind of that interaction place between the ground and the pond. And then it's popping up downstream. And the beauty of it all is it's popping up later in the year. So we're seeing sometimes out in eastern Oregon on these arid environments where you only have 8 to 10 inches of precipitation in the year, sometimes we're seeing streams that are getting another 30 or 45 days of water flow downstream that they otherwise would have lost earlier in the season. It would have just all rushed out to the ocean, basically.
Because they have beavers above them or around them that has
Yeah.
stored that.
Exactly. They act like speed bumps, right? That's how I like to think of this. You know, I just did a talk last night and I was thinking this through that we have been relying on, especially on working lands, you know, where water is life and And we're out working on the lands, and we need waters for our livestock. We need it for the wildlife. And it's really these dry environments out here. The water is everything. And we've relied on snow water equivalent. We've relied on the snowpack up in the mountains to provide us with that water over time. But we're losing that water bank. We know that drought is increasing. We know that temperatures are getting warmer, and we just don't have the same snowpacks that we had. Our banking system really was that
Right.
snow, and we're going to be losing that in time. So, we have very aligned interests with the beavers. So, if we can help them to do their thing, especially on these smaller wadable streams where they dam build for protection, then they can help us with those speed bumps and try and kind of slow that water down and keep it in place later in the season.
I have a very good friend who really dislikes the word watershed. She says that's exactly the opposite meaning of what it is. She says a watershed means to shed it away like a raincoat. A raincoat sheds the water off of your body. She says that is not what we're about. She says what we should be calling is the water catchment system. And she says the point is to catch that water and keep that water. And again, when we say catch it, we're not storing it for no one else's use, like the cement dams do. It stores it for our continued use longer through the year. We have huge rains right now in our area, and I'm so resentful of the streams of water going down my driveway that I want to get out there and somehow catch that water. Every drop that goes down the driveway, I'm like, wait, come back. Because she has taught me to think that way. That water needs to be stored. And the beavers do that. I have another friend who says, well, no, beavers. She says, you're a fisherman. She says, don't beavers stop the river so you can't fish it? Because if they have a dam, there's no more water. So tell me about the relationship with salmon and dams and beavers, because certainly the salmon are finding a river in spite of beaver dams.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. There's a bumper sticker out here in Eastern Oregon. Beaver taught salmon how to jump.
Okay,
And
explain that.
you gotta think about that. Beavers or salmon do jump, right? So I mean, it does seem like it would be fairly problematic. And I think a lot of the fish people in the early days of this kind of this beaver-related restoration idea and putting in these fake beaver dams and the idea of beaver recovery on the land, it gave a lot of fishing people pause. But if you start to think about it, they really did evolve together over time.
Right.
So how did that actually happen? Well, if we think about when a lot of salmon, a lot of trout in our area, a lot of these fish spawn, they're spawning during kind of when the flows subside, right? Like the flows come down and then they're coming up in the spring and late spring, and there is water that's coming around these dams. So the dams aren't, like we talked about, they're not holding the water in all the time. I mean, the water is actually breaching these dams. So the fish are able to get over those breaches. They're also, like, if you look at some of the trail camera footage from Seattle, where there's a fair bit of kind of city living with salmon and beavers, you'll see that the salmon are actually pretty well equipped at knocking holes into the beaver dams. So, some of my favorite videos will show a big group of salmon just sitting underneath a beaver dam over a period of days, and they just keep poking at it and poking at it and poking at it, and eventually they're able to breach that dam and swim on upstream. So, I think the salmon, like, salmon aren't stupid. They've got
Right.
this figured out. And the other thing, if you think about why these beaver ponds are so important to the fish, is again, it creates different habitat, right? Channels create little side channels that the beavers create, creates little slow areas for fish and fry to be able to escape from bigger fish. It creates just different topography within the pond itself. Even the dam itself creates little hiding areas for the fish. So what I think beavers do when you get a messier stream system and you get anabranching channels from beavers when they're really in there doing their thing is you actually get more habitat, more varied habitat for the young fish when they're the most vulnerable and they need that extra help. They need the water slowed. They need the extra shade that comes from dams or from Maybe some conifer trees that have died off because they've been wetted out by the beaver dam. So it just makes our stream systems more complex. And that is just a good thing for the fish and all of the other critters in there as well.
Well, what about the farmer who has cattle near that area? Does that ruin his land for his cattle? Because it sounds like it turns it into a little bit of a swampy area because the water's being pushed out from the dam, making areas around the stream swampy. How does the farmer work with that if he wants his cattle to use that particular pasture?
Boy, that is a great question because, of course, cattle and livestock wasn't around 200 years ago, right?
Right,
And
right.
so beaver never had to worry about that. But beaver and cattle are actually very compatible. The key is really grazing management. So ideally, you really don't want your cows hanging out on a riparian stream for weeks and weeks on end. You want to get them in there, get them doing their thing on the good forage that the beavers are providing and their damming is providing. And then you want to move them on to other pastures. So just basic riparian health and good grazing management practices would suggest that you don't want them hanging out on that beaver zone for all too long anyway. And what we're trying to do, working with landowners out here, whether they're farmers or ranchers with cattle or livestock, is to actually fence off a buffer zone. So, NRCS CREP has some great programs for doing this, and there's a few other local programs that will help to take those riparian reaches out of production. And then you can still put water gaps in there. So you can provide an alleyway so the cows can get access to the water. But
Right.
then you're able to keep the majority, say you keep 90 or 95% of that stream, keep the cows out of there, or only bring them in there for a really limited period of time, and then move them off. That way you can have the beavers in place. You don't have the cows in there disrupting their den sites or even their dam sites. I mean, cows can do a lot of destruction to beaver dams. I have one landowner that I work with over here in Prineville, who has grazing on about five gigantic beaver dams that are in place. It's a grazing allotment. And over time, we've been watching his cows deteriorate those dams. And
Right.
the problem is for him, those dams are what's providing water for his cows in August and September when the heat comes. And so what we were able to do is talk about how do we keep, let the cows stay there and get the good forage that they can, but let's keep them off of those dam sites. So we went through and put some hot wire up to keep the cows off and to keep them off those really sensitive riparian areas too. So now for his cows, he's got cleaner water and the dams are able to stay in place and the beavers aren't getting pockmarked den sites where they feel like they can't be compatible there and they need to move on. So it's kind of working out for everybody. Of course, we need to check that hot wire pretty regularly and make sure that we don't get shorted out or, create a fire hazard with having the hot wire in there.
Right.
But so far, it seems to be working pretty well. It's been in there for about a year. And really, to see the dams now are starting to get taller and we're starting to see more activity with the beavers now that they're not needing to repair cow damage all the time.
Okay. For our guests just tuning in, this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with Reese Mercer about the magnificent ecosystem engineer, the beaver. Now, Reese, I was telling you about the water running down my street here. That water that's running, and it's not a street, it's a driveway, a dirt driveway, but still that water is out of here. It's running down really quite quickly. It's digging little trenches in my driveway. And I know that's not, water's not feeding any plants. So no grass is growing next to that water, for instance, because it's running down so quickly. And that's why I'm wondering about beavers' dams. Without that dam, I would imagine a stream would just run quickly through a field and out to the ocean. And once it's to the ocean, we've lost that water. So tell me how these dams help spread that water out. That water doesn't still stay in that channel. Does it spread farther out?
What we're really talking about is erosion, right? And
Right, right.
this is where a podcast format is a little tricky, and
You're right.
I'm trying to get better and better at creating a visual depiction of what this looks like, but you're already noticing it in your driveway. So
Right.
without those dams, those speed bumps slowing the water down, we get increased pressurized water, right? And so it acts like your thumb on a hose in the backyard in the summertime. So there's no friction on that water coming down. And so what it does is it moves faster as it accumulates throughout the whole system. Because really, and I was thinking about this earlier as you were talking about catchments, and I
Right.
love that idea of a catchment. You know, what we've gotten to in the last 100 years, really, as we have irrigation districts, and you know, the whole goal has been hu of human engineering with irrigation and farming and ranching has been to control the water and move it the way that we want. So if you think about it, a lot of times we call our water catchments drainages.
You're
And
right.
I always sort of cringe when I hear the word drainage, because it's like, no, that's not really what it is. I mean, that's what we've made it over time. So if our streams are thought of as drainage systems, what's the goal of a drainage system? Is to move the water from point A to point B as fast as we can. So if we're turning on our headgate upstream a mile away from us, and we want to water 400 acres of alfalfa, and we want to start doing it this afternoon or this morning before it gets all too hot out, we want that water to arrive as fast as possible.
Right.
But think about what we're doing is we're creating erosion. So I do have some landowners right now that I'm working with. They want beaver in their drainage. They have a water delivery system. They've got a big reservoir upstream, and 3 miles downstream, they've got two different points of diversion where they're watering alfalfa fields. And I'm so excited because they want beavers in there, and we've been working with them to put in fake beaver dams, right? Because beavers
Right.
aren't in there totally building yet. And so we're putting fake beaver dams in to help do what beaver dams can do without having the beavers there, which is to slow that water down and spread it out and slow it down. And so it seems really contrary when I work with a ranch manager to say, you know, this is going to slow down your water delivery, because what we're doing is we're converting your 3 mile drainage into a connected floodplain with beavers and beaver dams. And our whole goal with this is to slow the water down. So you're
Right.
right. There's a lot going on there. But they're excited about it because they want to see those beavers in the system. They want to see the water slowing down and holding on to the landscape longer. They want to see their eroded channels from their drainage system. They want to see those get built back up with the sediment that comes down, and both the beaver dam analogs and eventually the beavers in time to have their dams actually hold that sediment in and start to turn those very tight, narrow corridor drainages into connected floodplains that the water spreads out, and we start getting more and more of those big, broad beaver valley meadow floors in place.
Listening to you, it makes me just think how important words are, because drainage does mean like a bathtub. When you drain your bathtub, you're getting rid of the water. And when we think of a drainage system, it's not about water catchment, it's about getting rid of the water. You know, another word I have a negative connotation of speaking with people is sediment. Again, as a fisherman, people don't like sediment
Oh,
because
sure.
sediment means cloudy. It means dirty. It means the fish can't see your bait. It means sediment somehow has a connection with almost pollution. And so, can you tell me about what sediment is and how sediment benefits our river?
Yeah, and especially now, think about, I mean, look at the Elwha Dam, and maybe this is the reversed example, but the Elwha Dam up in Washington State has had a lot of sediment run out now that they removed those dams. They had two dams up there and they removed them, I think maybe about 10 or 20 years ago. And there was all that sediment. There was a big flush of sediment because it was being held back in those artificial man-made dams for, gosh, I think 100 years or so. And so you're right, too much sediment can be a problem. But when you get sediment that is held back in places where we're where we've had too much erosion in those drainages, we want sediment. So where I work out here in Eastern Oregon, a lot of the landscape is what we call channelized. It's gullified. It's disconnected floodplains. So, when those dams got removed, the water came through so fast that it eroded all of that sediment that had
Right.
accumulated for millennia, thanks to the beavers. It eliminated all of that sediment. So many of the places where we're working, you've got 20-foot cliffs. They're gullies where the water has eroded down to the, in many cases, the bedrock. And so keeping that sediment on the land in those cases is a really big important goal for us out here where the streams are gullified. And you're right, too much sediment is definitely not a good thing. But you can't get around it, right? It's coming down from our uplands. It's there. It's dirt. It's rock. It's accumulated geology over eons of time. It's, we can't avoid sediment, but the beaver dams can help to hold some of that sediment in, just as they were doing out on the Elwha. And of course, as you have more sediment, you get bigger and more beaver dams, you get bigger and wider valley bottom floors as that sediment starts to grade and spread it all out.
And we could think of sediment as really nutrient-rich, rich soil
And
coming down.
it absolutely can be right if we've got organic matter in there for sure.
And another one of my favorite animals is lamprey. And I now understand that the lamprey's larval stage is 2 to 7 years in sediment. And
No
from what I
kidding. Huh.
as larvae before they even have eyes, they
Wow.
spend 2 to 7 years in the sediment.
Amazing.
And from what I understand, not in a river, but rather in these channels, these side channels that are quiet and calm.
Wow.
So, and the lamprey is, that's an animal that's survived five extinctions, mass extinctions.
No
It's
kidding.
one of the oldest
Wow.
animals we have around that we still have. He's a lovely little animal. so again, words have meaning and words have weight. The word rodent, again. I think many animals are characterized and divided into groups based on their teeth. And the beaver has teeth that grow like a rodent's teeth. So, the rat is not a favorite of many people, but they're a rodent and their teeth keep growing and growing. And talk to me about the beaver. Tell me about, do they eat trees? Do they have to have trees to eat? And will they destroy every tree on the property?
Beavers eat trees. Beavers eat the cambium layer of the tree, which I'm learning is the stem, sort of the stem cells of the tree. So it's a very, very important type of a cell within the tree. I've read that the cambium layer can taste like a carrot, but this is it's the living, growing part of the tree, and it embodies the outside. It's just the layer below the bark, and it's not lignified, it's fresh live cells. And then it is also providing the interior vascular system of the tree as well. The cambium is on the all of the new growth in the sticks. So all of the branches of the tree and the leaves that all has cambium layer on it. And that's the piece that the beavers really love. The challenge is, when a beaver takes down a tree, they're not necessarily interested in that trunk of the tree. What they're interested in is all that wonderful new growth. So, riparian trees like willows or aspen or cottonwoods are really, poplars are some of their favorite fast-growing poplar trees. So it's some of their favorite food. They only eat trees. They're vegetarian, and they'll primarily eat those poplars where they can. They're known to eat a lot of other things like western red cedar and maple and sometimes currant. I mean, one of the reasons they are successful in many, many different environments is that they're known as a choosy generalist. So they can eat almost any kind of tree that there is and sustain themselves on those trees. They have their favorites, but they can also adapt to other types of species. When they eat the tree or the cambium layer on the tree, they are only able to digest a third of that, is sort of what the nutritionists will tell you. So a third of what they take into their system is digestible. And so that means they're pretty wasteful when they harvest. And one of the challenges for us with trying to put beaver habitat back on the landscape for natural beaver recovery is that you just don't know how much they need. I mean, they need a beaver family. So if you had an average family of five, it's kind of what beaver people refer to as an average family size. So five beavers, five adult beavers, but you've got juveniles in there and babies, but just say you have five adult beavers, just for the sake of argument. An average family of five beavers, it said, can harvest about 1,200 trees in one season. And so, if you want beavers there for the long term, adult beaver can have kids starting in her third year for 12 years, going up until 12 years in the wild is their average lifespan. So, let's say you want her there for 8 to 9 years doing her thing, and then you want her offspring in there doing her thing. That's 8 to 9 years times 1,200 trees. That's about 10,000 trees that a beaver will need for that family of five to be successful over that adult beaver's lifetime. So that's a lot of trees. And the challenge for us really is if you start putting trees in that are unprotected, or you just put in 1,000 trees, what you haven't done is built up enough of a threshold, because when they come in, they're going to come in and hit it hard. They need building materials and they need nutrition to start their family. So they're going to hit it hard, and you need to have a critical mass. And that's really important. They have sort of this rotational crop system. So what they'll do is they'll start out, and it's generally believed that their territorial reaches are about a half a mile. So think of 10,000 trees spread along a half mile of stream, and all you want it as close as possible to that stream so that they can escape from predators as quickly as possible. So let's say that a beaver couple moves in, they say, great place to do our thing. Looks like we've got enough food in here. They'll move in at one section of that stream that they're kind of their home base, if you will, and they'll start harvesting close to home. And as they harvest close to home, over time, they'll start to deplete that assortment of food. They'll harvest it down. Well, that's all usually quick growing food, but they don't have enough for the second or the third or the fourth year. So then they'll start moving upstream. They'll build another den upstream, and they'll start harvesting upstream off of that new food source. So what they'll do is start moving back and forth within that system over the years and just harvesting locally throughout that whole territorial reach. But it's important to get enough of that food in there early on. Otherwise, they'll just wipe it out and quickly, and then they'll run out of food. And that's what I see at a lot of stream restoration sites where the food has been depleted, maybe in competition with livestock grazing over 100 years. And it's almost impossible to get that vegetation going again without additional kind of human intervention to really get things established. So all of our trees, all of our vegetation planting gets caged off, and it seems a little cruel, but we do cage it all off from the beavers so that in the first 5 years, while that vegetation is getting established and we're trying to get the highest survival rate possible, we don't allow the beavers to have any access, because it would be counterproductive really to their interests.
So what are they eating then?
Well, they're not sticking around in that case. So they'll just move on, and they'll go upstream, and they're known to travel for miles and miles and miles to find satisfactory habitat that they can settle into.
What if a farmer rancher has a lovely spread and a beautiful river and creek and plenty of trees? Can he go out and just bring in some beaver?
Great question. I do get phone calls like that. Beavers will, ODFW will tell you this, and I tend to agree. If you have the right habitat there, they'll find you.
They'll
They
find
will
you.
come to you. They can travel on land quite far, actually. They travel, it's sort of the conventional thinking is kind of on average, they can travel up to 20 miles on land. Of course, there's a lot of obstacles along the way, cars sometimes, And predators. I mean, they move really slow on land, anywhere from 4 to 5 miles per hour to, I've clocked one at 7 miles per hour at a high sprint running back to the stream. So they move pretty slow. Their average predator can run anywhere from 30 to 40 miles an hour. So they're kind of toast on land, but they do get through. And so if the right habitat conditions are there, beavers will show up. They will find you. And I've had this conversation with a lot of landowners who feel like they really have the right conditions. They want to relocate beavers into their property. And that's a real important issue that I struggle with around this idea of relocating beavers and trying to speed up Mother Nature, right? Like, where does speeding up Mother Nature ever get us? And so, knowing that beavers can travel and they're known to travel 20 miles over land, they're known to travel 90 miles in one season to try and find that habitat. I think we need to m let Mother Nature take her time. When we relocate beavers, it's very disruptive to them. They're very shy animals. They die a lot of times on trapping, in handling during husbandry. They can die from the stress just of being handled, of being looked at and poked at. And then even on release, a lot of times we release them into areas where there might already be beavers in territorial areas. And so it's sort of believed that one in three relocations actually ends up in beavers sticking around and doing what you want them to do. And so what happens to the other two-thirds of those beavers? They usually get eaten or they move off. And then you also haven't really, where you have a problem beaver area, you haven't really addressed the fact that if the beavers keep moving in, it's because they like that place. You have the right habitat. And so for the landowner who has problem beavers or problem beaver area, you're not really addressing the root cause of them being there in the first place. So I think some of the solutions out of the Beaver Institute on the East Coast, or like Jacob Shockey is providing in kind of the Roseburg, Canyonville area, you know, putting in these flow devices, or I'm calling them beaver cheaters, where you can kind of outsmart the beaver and adapt your infrastructure so they don't slow down that water, I think is really a better alternative to actually relocating beavers.
Well, tell me what that is, though, these flow adapters. Tell me about a little bit about the technology that we're trying to implement to help them.
Yeah, so it really is pretty basic equipment, cattle panels, which a lot of us know, especially if you live out in the country. Cattle panels can be used in a number of different ways to make the wrong thing easy and the right thing, what is it, the wrong thing hard and the right thing easy. By, for example, if you have a culvert that the beavers are plugging up, what you want to do, you know, that culvert is a great pinch point. A lot of our culverts out here are 4 foot culverts, and when we're able to give them a head start on building that dam by just creating a little narrow 4 foot area that they need to dam up, they're like, hey, we're going for it. So what you can do a lot of times is extend the area that they would need to dam by putting some of that cattle panel over that culvert, but you extend it out in a way that kind of foils the beaver, where they think like, this is a lot of work. We had a 4 foot area that we were damming on pretty nicely before, and now all of a sudden we've got 30 feet that if we want to achieve the same result with our beaver dam, now we have to build a 30-foot dam because you've just put 30 feet of cattle panel in front of that culvert. So those devices are called, there's a bunch of different words, keystone fences, trapezoidal fences. They're very effective. They have a 95% success rate when you do them correctly. There's another device too, which was recently installed, for example, over in Corvallis. And hats off to the city of Corvallis for, you know, trying to find ways to work with the beaver, right? Because that city has a lot of development in the floodplain, so right where beavers are. And so one of their goals is to get that water off the land as fast as possible. And having a lot of beaver dams in place is kind of problematic for city engineers. So what we did over there where the beavers were damming up a local city park is put in what's called a flow device. And that really includes some piping that goes into the dam. And it doesn't completely prevent the flooding from happening, but what it does is attenuate. If you have a large rain, It leaves more room in that channel for the water to dissipate and spread out over time, so that the large rain events or just large water events are really minimized. So that's a little bit more viable and a little bit more livable, so that you don't have water hanging out on the land all the time because of these beaver dams.
All these implementations you're talking about, do landowners have any resources to help them? Is this a cost they have to take upon themselves, or are there places they can go to get some assistance, some guidance, and some even financial assistance?
Yeah, so I think Oregon, just as a state, we've been a little slower maybe than some of the other places on this, but we are catching up. Western Beavers Cooperative, my organization, we do provide technical expertise and advice on how to put the infrastructure in. A lot of times, as I mentioned, these are things that you might already have around in the barnyard. So we're calling them kind of barnyard solutions. We've got flyers that we can provide to help to help you think like a beaver. There's
Right.
definitely a wrong way to put the devices in, and so sometimes if you try it without kind of seeking out expertise, you could get frustrated on your first pass. It's not always a set it and forget it. Sometimes you need to kind of come back a few times and kind of outsmart the beaver as they up their game. But right now, I'd say ODFW, definitely a phone call into them. And they know the other resources. Like we get phone calls from referred to us from ODFW around implementing these devices. There is a fair bit and a growing bit of advice available on the internet too, through the Beaver Institute. Beaver Project also provides some materials on their website. So the information is out there, but the funding really has been something that's taken a little bit of time to catch up. So I'm really focused right now on kind of DIY solutions that
Right.
are really where the landowner can do the work themselves. I mean, if you have a farm or a ranch, you probably have T-posts, you probably have T-post pounders, and you probably have cattle panel and
Right.
fence wire. So a lot of times you already have the equipment that's available, and it doesn't cost much more to reuse or upcycle, if you will, an old cattle panel that you've got
Right.
hanging out in the barnyard somewhere.
All right, let me go back to some of the bad reputation of beavers. I hear some people say they're a dangerous animal. It's a big animal. Can't they get 50, can they get that large 50,
They
60 pounds?
can. Yeah, you bet.
So isn't that dangerous? Won't they bite your child and bite your cow?
Remember how slow they are. We talked about this. They're slow and they're shy. Yeah, they have big teeth, but they're really not known to be aggressive at all. I mean, the very, very few examples I've heard of beavers biting a dog or beavers even biting a human is usually when they're being harassed by said human or said dog.
Right.
So their bigger inclination, if they're feeling threatened, is to run back to the pond and escape and get into that safety of the water. So yeah, they're not really known for being aggressive or even very effective. Although there's a wonderful video on the internet, sort of a Disney style video of a beaver taking on a mountain lion, which is just hard to even imagine. But where this video goes, he re keeps retreating back to the safety of the water, and then he pops out every once in a while to take on the mountain lion
Right.
who's trying to eat him for lunch. So you
Right.
can't blame him really. But it really is a good illustration in the video, and they say this, that this is why beavers need water, is because they are, I read this not long ago, that they are considered more aquatic than terrestrial.
Okay. So they do have web feet, for instance.
They have big web feet, and
Right.
that's one reason they're so slow too, right? They've got to get
Right, sure,
past
yeah.
those big, it's the back feet that are webbed. It's the front feet that are more like hands, like humans.
Okay,
Very, yeah, very nimble and what would you call it? Dexterous
Yeah, like a raccoon,
fingers.
perhaps, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, how about disease? Remember, they're a rodent, right? And rodents carry diseases.
Yeah, I think beavers have gotten a little bit of a bum rap on that. And
Right.
when people ask me about disease, I'm not super expert on this. I know tularemia is a problem, and potentially Giardia. And Of course, they do slow this water down, and sometimes they can even make it anaerobic. So those are slow ponds, are areas where you can get more disease spread. But I think that it's kind of been dispelled that they're not big carriers of diseases themselves, although they will from time to time transmit it to each other. And this is another reason why we don't really love relocation, is that if they do have beaver-borne diseases and beaver-based diseases, they could be spreading that to other beavers. But yeah, I think by and large, they're not carrying a lot of these diseases as you might find rats carrying the plague or something like this. It's more a condition of the slowing water and having anaerobic conditions that might be fostering those diseases.
Right. And diseases are usually carried through kind of gross stuff, like
Yeah.
fecal matter and dead animals and whatnot. And again, that's what rats like. Rats like dead animals. They like fecal matter. They like gross things where diseases kind of hang out. And of course, beavers, do beavers eat fish?
They do not. They
Another
don't.
rumor.
And so when you actually look at beaver fecal matter, as you can probably imagine, since their only diet consists of wood and herbaceous species, they poop sawdust. And it's really quite delightful when you look at a freshly occupied beaver pond in the kind of their primary ponding area. A lot of times you can just see these little compact turds, for lack of a better word, about 2 to 3 inches long, and they are all sawdust. And when you go to pick them up, they pretty much just sort of disintegrate in your hand. But it's all sawdust. It's very clean, right? It's all just vegetation and organic matter.
Which sounds like great fertilizer.
100%.
Right. Another fun kind of rumor is that the beavers carry mud on their tails, and they use your tails to pat their dams together and build sculptures with their tails.
I haven't seen that. One thing they use their tails for is to hold fat reserves, which gets them through the winter in the cold areas.
Okay.
They use it as a rudder. They use it for balance. They're up on their hind legs a lot, carrying mud onto their den sites to do den repair and create their dens. So they do spend a lot of time kind of vertically up on trees, harvesting trees. And so I think they use their tail a lot for balance as well, and probably for steering as they're swimming through ponds. But I haven't really seen them use
Yeah,
them to build sculptures yet. But I'll keep an eye open for that on my trail cameras.
I think it's probably a Disney movie. And one more thing, what about are they still is there still a market for beaver pelts and whatnot? Are they still hunted for purpose, or are they more hunted as pests?
I would say where I live, it's primarily pests, so it's
Okay.
beaver removal because they're problems. I don't know if there's big pelt markets anymore. I mean, from time to time I hear about these markets. The last I heard on pelts, they were selling for about $8 per beaver, so that probably doesn't even really pay for your gas to get out
Right.
there. By and large, I think the folks who are doing recreational trapping, and I believe we only have about 1,000 registered recreational trappers in the state. I mean, trapping is still a thing in many, many parts of the state. Less so in my area. We actually have a trapping moratorium on one of our major forests. So I just don't see it that much, but I do hear about it in other parts of the state. I think it's a way for trappers to just get out and be outdoors. You know, it's a pastime. It's something that they enjoy, and I don't think they're really making an economic living out of this. It feels like trapping is sort of an older sport. I don't see a lot of new trappers or young trappers, so that may sort of fall by the wayside here in Oregon over time, is my thought. But you know, a lot of folks are really concerned about trapping, and if you think about the reasons why, it makes sense. You know, it's like recreational torture, basically. I mean, it's really, really hard on these critters, the way these traps work, and basically drowning beavers. And when you take away the potential of more and more beaver babies, and like you say, they're rodents and they breed every year, you know, you take away a lot of good stuff that they can do on the landscape if we can just learn maybe to adapt our human infrastructure that we've put in rather than removing them. And that's really going to be key for us here in Oregon, I think, is getting more and more of the adapted infrastructure in place.
Reese, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your wisdom and your guidance. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Reese Mercer of the Western Beavers Cooperative. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you can find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.